So Costa Diamantis was convicted by a federal jury on all 21 corruption charges he faced, including extortion and bribery. The charges were related to his role that he was holding previously running the state school construction grant office. And even the governor, you know it's serious when the governor sends a press release to the media and all it says is statement from Governor Lamont with no context at all until you open it up. And he says, in part, public service is a public trust. The conviction of Mr. Diamantis is a stark reminder that when that trust is violated, there are consequences. Joining us on the show is political reporter Mike Cerulli from News 8. And Mike, I don't know if I'm talking out of turn. Were you the only reporter who spoke to Costa Diamantis during his trial?
No, there were a lot. Great to be back, Melissa. There were a lot of folks who spoke with him.
Really?
The course of the trial.
Your interview stood out to me.
Yeah, there was this moment a couple days ago as he was waiting for the verdict where he was sort of camped out at this Italian restaurant.
Yeah, the deli or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or the coffee shop, something like that.
Yeah, it's a pizza shop about a block from the courthouse. And I popped in there and spoke with him at length. And there was actually another reporter who was there as well, Dave Altamare from the Connecticut Mirror, who's
a very seasoned
investigative reporter. And mm-hmm. he wrote this great headline about the fact that Costa was at this place waiting for his verdict. So folks can check that out online. But yeah, there's been a lot of interactions with Costa over the course of the trial. I will say a lot of the time he'll walk out of the courtroom and reporters will try to ask him questions and he'll just sort of brush them off, maybe say one or two words or a line or something like that. But I will say the other day at that restaurant was one of the more comprehensive interactions certainly that I've had with him.
Yeah.
Throughout the trial.
Do you feel like that was a good move on his part? I was a little surprised that he was so interactive with the media. I mean, especially when you have such a high profile local attorney like Norm Pattis, who is no stranger to the media. I was surprised that that was a move of it, because to me, he really, I mean, in his interview with you, he really came off as, look, I don't feel like I did anything ethically or legally wrong. And he's like, if I knew it was going to make so much trouble, I'd go back and not do it again only because I shouldn't be in this situation. It felt to me very like he was very, very confident. And granted, you have to obviously have a level of that, right? Because you're trying to avoid prison time. But do you feel like that was not a good move? I mean, obviously you're in the media, so it was great that you got the interviews. But do any legal experts feel like that was maybe not a smart move for him to just be so open with the media during his trial? It's pretty rare.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm necessarily the expert to advise on the public relations strategy, but I will say there were a couple lawyers who just sort of said to me, you know, he kind of has to watch what he says because if it's interpreted that he's trying to influence the decision somehow through maybe. Obviously, the jurors were instructed throughout this not to read press reports, not to go online, not to watch the news. But, you know, if it's interpreted that maybe he's trying to get to them, maybe that would become another level of problems for him. But other than that, I mean, the best I could tell from my interactions with him and obviously watching him in court as well, he was very convinced that, you know, he was very convinced that his argument, that someone was going to listen to his argument. I can't say whether or not he actually believes he did nothing wrong. That's something that I don't think you can know in a situation like this, what someone really feels on the inside like that. But he certainly felt as though someone was going to listen to his argument, and I think adamantly felt that, as evidenced by his decision to testify, which the foreperson of the jury yesterday, upon walking out of the courtroom or courthouse, pretty blatantly told us in the press, she was like, I think he hurt himself when he was doing that because he did not come off as credible to her, at least. You know, she can't speak for the other jurors, but at least in her view, as a leader among the jurors, she said just his demeanor and his everything about him was not credible. They didn't find it credible. So
wow,
it was an interesting dissonance, right? This person who seemed very confident in themselves, and then a juror who just said, you know,
that was actually what could have been his demise. That's interesting. And again, as I mentioned, Norm Pattis is somebody you got to kind of focus on as well in these types of cases. I was not shocked that he was hired. We've seen him in high profile cases like this before in Connecticut. He was telling you, though, that he was feeling confident in this in the legal system because the jury really didn't know what to do. It wasn't a quick done deal. We know we're going to go this way or that. Right. I mean, what was sort of the feeling in the court when it was read that he was going to be convicted on every count?
Silent. There was not any sort of animated reactions that people might, you know, see on TikTok or something, some courtroom video of someone reacting very, very extremely to a guilty verdict. He sat silently, didn't make any kind of moves that I could see, you know, in terms of putting his head down, you know, collapsing or something like that. He was seated, which someone who doesn't really cover courts, like, you know, I was actually a little surprised when the judge just took the thing and started reading, and he was just like, count one, guilty, count two, guilty. There was no sort of stand and face the jury. I will say one of the more notable parts, and I was speaking to someone who was in the courtroom who is very seasoned at these legal proceedings, and the judge does something at the end where he just pulls the jurors and says, juror two, is this your true verdict? And they say yes. And this person who I was talking to, who's, I don't want to say their name, but a seasoned person in the legal system, said, you know, you could hear in a few jurors' voices that they were emphatically saying, yes, this is my verdict. It was not a timid or shy sort of jury poll. There were several jurors where you could hear it in their voice that they were, maybe proud is the wrong word for it, but certainly they stood by their decision to convict.
There was nothing wavering about their decision to convict. Mm-hmm. You got that sense. We're chatting with political reporter Mike Cerulli from News 8. And major news this week, Costa Diamantis, who is Connecticut's former deputy budget director. He had been running the state school construction grant office. He was just convicted by a federal jury on all 21 corruption charges he faced. And Mike, how long does he now have in prison?
So we'll find out in January when he's sentenced. He's
okay.
Actually out free right now and was allowed to leave the court and with a promise to return back. Norm Pattis said, in Norm's words, that Costa would be lucky to get, you know, less than 10 or 12 years. The judge who's presiding over the case, Judge Underhill, a very respected jurist, but does have a reputation as someone who will sometimes exercise his own judgment and give sentences that are lower than the federal sentencing guidelines might instruct. I've heard people use words like lenient. Those are not my words. I'm not a lawyer. I don't practice in Judge Underhill's court, certainly. So I'm not going to characterize that, but I've heard people say that about Judge Underhill. At the same time, I've also heard people say, specifically Ryan McGuigan, who's a former prosecutor and currently a defense attorney, that Judge Underhill, in his words, he said Judge Underhill really has an aversion to people who betray the public trust. So you could see a situation where this judge really comes down hard on Costa and gives him, you know, something more than 12 years, maybe something in the 15 year or more range. So it's really tough to predict these things. There's sort of a calculation that happens in terms of the federal sentencing guidelines. And one of the parts of the calculations will be the sort of damages, so to speak, that were done by the Corrupt Act. And they have not yet calculated that number yet. So depending on how high that number is, they'll add more points when they go in to calculate what this recommended sentence should be.
And this probably sounds like a silly question, Mike, but was it the state who pushed for this trial?
He was prosecuted by the federal government. So
okay.
So this is sort of one of the that question sort of dovetails with one of Costa's defense strategies, which is Norm Pattis argues, and I would assume still vehemently believes that some of the issues here were not sort of interstate issues, which would invoke the federal jurisdiction. But on the other hand, if you talk to certain people who have been around the legal system in Connecticut, one thing they will tell you is that the state government, its prosecutors, the people who prosecute everything from traffic tickets on up to capital murder, that they don't really have like the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI have a public corruption unit that just goes around and investigates these things. And as a matter of fact, they're prosecuting Costa for a whole other matter. They're scheduled to do that in February. So they have these resources that are focused on government corruption. And again, if you talk to certain people, they will say that the state doesn't necessarily have itself an equal sort of capacity to do that, to investigate itself. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But
right. But, I mean, the reason I was asking that, Mike, is because, you know, after this was announced in court, immediately the Republican Party for the state, they immediately, you know, wanted to double down. In fact, I've got a direct quote here. I'm sure you have it as well. But from Senator Steve Harding, the minority leader in our Senate, he says corruption at the highest level of Connecticut government, bribery, extortion, recklessness, arrogance, from Diamantis to the state peer debacle to the CSCU Chancellor Chang scandal to the unvetted nonprofit candy store grants. The disrespect for taxpayers' money is widespread in Connecticut state government. We view it as a creeping culture of corruption. Now, you know, solid points or solid examples, I should say. But it's, you know, the examples he gave besides Diamantis, those did not go to trial. In fact, Chancellor Chang just stepped down from his role, but is still working in some capacity at CSCU, making six figures, by the way. We don't know what he's doing, but you know what I'm saying? So those are all great examples that the senator's talking about, but only Diamantis actually went to trial for, again, breaking public trust, essentially.
Well, to be fair to the federal government and their operations, they're investigating at least one, maybe two of the things that you just mentioned there. They're certainly investigating the nonprofit funding that Senator Harding mentioned, the COVID grants that were flowed into Connecticut and then flowed out from the state coffers to these nonprofits. We know from the reporting of Ed Mahoney at the Hartford Courant and others that there are subpoenas flying left and right from the federal government for information specifically related to one state senator, Douglas McCrory, who's a Hartford Democrat, and some nonprofits in that area. So, and there's also indications that they are actively looking into the state peer program, including Costa Diamantis' involvement in some of those things. So there are certainly ongoing investigations into some of those things that the senator mentioned. It takes a while to build these cases. I mean, we sat through 2 weeks of trial, and you would sort of see the lawyers cart in their gigantic 3-inch binders every morning with all the evidence in it. And of course, they had to go through that. They had to sort it. They had to, I'm assuming, argue over what's, you know, they're going to use and what they're going to not use and what they can and can't use. So these cases take a long time. But to the broader point that the Republicans make, and I don't think necessarily Steve made it in this statement, but I've heard him make it elsewhere, which is the state government, they have actually called for, the Republicans have called for, like, an inspector general function inside the state government. There's been years of conversation about why the state's election enforcement commission that enforces our elections laws, which catches some but not all political malfeasance, it sort of act like an early warning system for this type of certain types of malfeasance in our elections. They take years to investigate and even refer claims to state prosecutors. Legislators have tried to speed that process up, but you know, there are a lot of open-ended questions about things the state government could do to sort of police itself a little bit better. You know,
but even if they do, the effectiveness of it, I mean, what's funny is, like, I think the inspector general for state police, they are pretty effective and quick. But you're right, when it comes to elections, that's an entirely different story.
Yeah, so I think, you know, as you say, and you made a very good point there, right, which is the enforcement of this really does matter. And if you have a bad actor, right, they're called criminals for a reason, right? They take measures to subvert the law and evade detection. So it's going to be interesting to see how this informs the debate, perhaps the next legislative session, about additional steps that can be taken to empower public corruption investigators to crack down on this stuff. And I would say that the problem that this might run into is politicians of any kind generally are not going to be in favor of additional oversight of themselves, right? So And people, you could say, oh, well, what about this guy? He's good. He has integrity, so he'll support it. I would just look at the broader picture of it. And over 20 or 30 years of Connecticut history, what has been the trend in terms of the state empowering public corruption investigations?
Yeah. Well, and it continues to be questioned, but certainly there was praise, as I mentioned, from the Republicans saying that they got it right with the Diamantis case. And Mike Cerulli, excellent reporting as always. Thank you for, getting us up to speed with everything. And I guess we'll see what happens when Diamantis is back in a court in January. Thank you so much.